supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. A Mexican-born immigrant has moved into a Center City, Philadelphia church seeking sanctuary from immigration authorities. WHYY's Dave Davies reports.
Javier Flores has been in the country for nearly 20 years. He's married and has three children, all born in the U.S. He's been deported three times and returned, making him a high priority for deportation again under Immigration and Customs Enforcement policy. But Flores has a chance of staying in the country. His lawyer, Brennan Giangrasso, says he's applied for a special visa available to immigrants who suffered trauma from a crime and have cooperated with police and prosecutors.
He was assaulted in a parking lot in Bensalem and stabbed several times with box cutters by two men who attacked him. And Javier cooperated fully with the Bensalem Police Department. Ultimately, the two people who assaulted him pled guilty.
Flores would have an easier time getting the visa if it weren't for his arrests for re-entering the country after deportation. He recently spent more than a year in a detention center as authorities considered his case. He was released for a 90-day period, which has just expired. Giangrasso says Flores is needed to support his family, and he says two of his children have developed mental health problems in part from his absence and detention. Flores' wife, Alma Sanchez, says she's struggling to cope.
What's happening right now is very hard for me.
Sanchez says her daughter has attempted suicide and her four-year-old son won't play with his siblings, saying he wants to live in the church with his father. Flores sought sanctuary at the Arch Street United Methodist Church days before he was to report to immigration authorities. What happens next isn't clear. Immigration officials said in a statement they intend to adhere to existing policy to avoid apprehending people at sensitive locations, such as schools, hospitals, and places of worship, except in emergency circumstances. A woman who lived in a Kensington church for about 2 months under similar circumstances eventually had her deportation order lifted last year. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
There are charter schools in Philadelphia, and then there's the Mastery Charter School Network. Mastery is massive, educating more than 10,000 students across the city. And Mastery doesn't create new schools. Rather, it takes over struggling district schools and tries to revive them. Mastery has been hailed as a national leader in school turnaround, but over the past 2 years, the network's results have started to slip, and now Mastery's leaders are racing to figure out what went wrong. Details from WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
Adding multiple two-digit numbers together. That's what's on the menu today in Beth Wendell's third-grade class at Clymer Elementary School in North Philadelphia. And this lesson is being served two ways.
Now this, boys and girls, is the first way that Miss Wendell can show how to add these four numbers together.
First, she uses these little counting Legos. They're called base 10 blocks. They exist to show students the basic concept behind addition, so they can feel and see what these numbers mean.
That was using base 10 blocks. Let's use regular old paper and pencil.
Next, she uses the method that you probably remember from school. Wendell stacks four numbers on top of each other, adds the first column together, carries the one, etc.
When we do our next two together, we are going to use base 10 blocks and paper pencil to see which one you like better.
The quest to fix the biggest, most successful charter chain in Philadelphia hinges on this, a choice between what's worked in the past and what students need for the future. When Mastery started more than a decade ago, it used what education wonks call a no-excuses model that meant strict discipline in the hallways to establish order, and in the classroom it meant drilling students over and over again on familiar formulas.
And we are very focused on skills and procedures.
Scott Gordon is Mastery's CEO.
And there was a real focus on practice, 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 practice.
And it worked. Mastery became known nationally as a school turnaround artist. Even Oprah took note.
The Angel Network is giving each of your charter school networks $1 million.
$1 million for you.
But there was a downside. Mastery heard from alumni that the no-excuses model worked fine getting them through high school and even into college, and it was great for establishing order at a school that might have lacked it. But the kids weren't becoming self-sufficient as people or as learners. Oftentimes in college or the real world, they floundered.
They need to be able to be intrinsically motivated. They need to be able to learn how to learn. And so it seemed like the time that we were mature enough as an organization and our schools were mature, and frankly, our kids were mature enough to make a pretty big change.
2 years ago, Mastery ditched no excuses for a radical new approach. Classrooms became less strict and more student-directed. And instead of just teaching formulas and procedures, teachers focused on conceptual learning. Mastery really, in essence, wanted to emulate the type of learning environment a kid might find at a great private or suburban school.
We want our kids and believe that our kids can be competitive with kids anywhere.
After year one of this big change, test scores plummeted. Gordon figured it was growing pains. Then the second year of test scores came back.
It was a shock. It was very alarming, very surprising.
Peter Ruggiero teaches 7th grade math at Mastery Thomas in South Philadelphia. Students there used to score at or above the state average in math. Last year, they were at half the state average. And even though scores in general were dropping across the state as tests were changed to reflect the Common Core, Mastery scores dropped further.
Made me feel like a failure as a teacher, trying to figure out what did I do wrong. It was tough.
Last year, Peter Ruggiero's class was arranged in small clusters of desks where students dictated the pace. Now he's back in front of the room, and all the desks face forward. There are still traces of conceptual learning, but it's mixed with an equal dose of old-school methods. If the concepts aren't sticking with students, Ruggiero can now give them mnemonic devices or formulas so they can at least get the right answer.
So this is a little trick that's going to help us solve this and make it a little bit easier to solve. It doesn't always work with all the fractions we're going to be using, but it's going to work in this case.
Mastery thinks in all this, it can find a middle ground between old and new, and that its students will benefit from a mix. But to be realistic, there are politics at play here, too. If charter schools like Mastery don't produce good test results, they can be shut down. Because of its track record, Mastery isn't facing those consequences yet.
It's probably still a couple years away. It's not 10 years away, for sure.
Mark Gleason heads Philadelphia School Partnership, one of the region's largest private education funders. PSP has been a big backer of Mastery over the last 5 years. Gleason says he still believes in the organization.
But clearly, we're already at a point where we all need to be paying closer attention. We're not going to wait a year to find out how are things going at Mastery. We're going to want to see how are things going in November and January and March so that when state results come out a year from now, hopefully there aren't surprises.
Mastery has become a symbol for the entire school turnaround movement, for the idea that private management companies can improve schools that districts couldn't. It's a concept some education reformers love and some public school advocates love to hate. And to some extent, at least here in Philadelphia, its fate is tied up in Mastery's fate.
There is a promise between Mastery as an organization and the parents and families we serve that we're going to prepare your children and help your child grow to be the person they want to be. And right now we feel like we're not fulfilling that in the way that we believe we can. So we're going to fix it.
For years, Mastery has built its name, Fixing Broken Schools. Now the race is on to fix itself. I'm Avi Wolf-Manarant, WHYY News.
Gunshots claim the lives of nearly 1,400 Pennsylvanians each year. Public attention usually focuses on homicides, which is why it may come as a surprise that most gun-related deaths in the state are suicides. Here to provide insight is Public Sources' Jeff Benzing. Jeff, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us the process by which you pulled together data on this matter.
Sure. So I've been doing a series of stories on gun violence in Pennsylvania and started out just looking really broadly, trying to see where the main issues were, what was really causing the vast majority of the deaths. So here in Pittsburgh, where I'm sitting right now, gun violence, when you're looking at homicides, is a big issue. And of course, there in Philadelphia as well. But if you look at most areas in Pennsylvania, there's very few gun murders. We're talking counties that have zero for the year. Maybe a few you could count on one hand. But they do have gun deaths, and those are suicides. And that's something that gets very little attention, very little reporting. You don't see the headlines every day like you would for a shooting in Philadelphia or a shooting in Pittsburgh.
Why aren't gun suicides reported?
There's sort of the thought that you don't want to give attention to something that could then create copycats. There's privacy issues. And, you know, people are very sensitive to the stigma about it, which are things that do make sense. But then you get this sort of misleading impression of gun deaths. There's a national group focused on suicide prevention. And then there's also the national trade group for the firearms industry are trying this project, not in Pennsylvania yet, but they have four pilot states where they're trying to reach out directly to gun shops and shooting ranges and firearms instructors and to make sure that they, first of all, are aware that this is what's causing two-thirds of gun deaths, but also to make sure that they know if somebody's coming in and they may be at risk, what to look for, how to identify someone who maybe is going through a tough time, maybe has sort of displaying behavior where, you know, maybe I shouldn't sell a gun to this person right away.
Are the victims of self-inflicted gunshots typically the owners of those guns?
So these are folks who often have been handling guns their whole lives. A lot of them are veterans. So they're well-trained. They're familiar. Guns are not a scary thing. It's not something you just go out and buy and you don't know sort of what you're handling. These are often in areas where there's a really strong gun culture. People are hunters. They do shooting sports, and they're readily available.
Jeff Benzing, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Jeffrey Benzing of Public Source. Thousands of feral cats roam through neighborhoods and behind shopping centers in parts of northern Delaware. Now there's an effort underway to manage that population. WHYY's Mark Eichmann has more on one group that's trapping and sterilizing cats.
More than 10,000 free-roaming cats are believed to live just in the northern Delaware communities of Newcastle, Newark, and Bear. Felicia Cross, founder of Forgotten Cats, is working to control those numbers. We tagged along as she tried to trap a few living behind a row of townhomes.
So what we're going to do is we're just going to bait a couple of these and take them around. And you want to be very quiet and walk them in, place them, and leave.
When called by residents, volunteers with Forgotten Cats will place traps where a feral cat colony lives. The goal is to interrupt the reproductive process and keep the colony from growing.
Most caretakers that are feeding them, they don't intend to have a colony. They find one or two cats and they start feeding them, and the next thing you know, there's a litter, and then the litter has a litter, and before you know it, it goes out of control very quickly, and they feel totally overwhelmed.
The Forgotten Cats team traps and sterilizes an entire colony before returning any of the cats to the wild. Doing it that way can make a quick impact on that colony growth.
It's very easy. Within a week, a colony of two or 52 can be sterilized and under control.
After years of sterilizing up to 100 cats a day, the clinic runs like a well-oiled machine. From sedating the cats in their cages to shaving them in preparation for surgery, then it's into the operating room.
This is a female cat that we're about to spay. So she's tied down to the spay board just to make sure that she's positioned correctly for the surgery.
Dr. Jackie Martin has single-handedly sterilized roughly 50,000 over the past 10 years at Forgotten Cats.
I usually average between 60 and like 85 a day. And on really busy summer days, I've done over 110. So that's about the record.
In 2015, Forgotten Cats was awarded a $200,000 grant to target cat populations in Bear, Newark, and Newcastle. That work appears to be paying off. The grant was to fund 4,000 sterilizations from those communities. So far, 3,000 cats have been neutered or spayed.
The calls from the grant areas have slowed down considerably. So I'm not sure if that's because kitten season's over and it's not an urgency anymore, or it's because there aren't that many unsterilized colonies anymore. So I'm hoping that's the case.
Before releasing a sterilized cat, they test its personality to see if it could be adopted instead. But Forgotten Cats organizers say too many of them have been wild for so long that it's sometimes challenging to find ones that could adapt to moving indoors. From the Delaware Desk, I'm Mark Eichmann, WHYY News.
Looks like there's a chance of light showers in the forecast later this week. Let's get details with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, showers? Drizzle?
We're actually talking about micrometeorolates coming into the Earth's atmosphere to become meteors. This is the landed meteor shower time of the year. Always November 15th through November 20, the shower peaks on the 18th, and the micrometeoroids are the product of dust and detritus melting out of the nucleus of a particular comet, Comet Tempel-Tuttle. This is an interesting meteor shower because it has a reputation as being a very intense shower with lots of meteors to be seen. The unfortunate thing about it is that that kind of shower activity for this one happens only about every 33 to 35 years or so. There's this very, very intense shower. The last time this happened was in 2002 when 3,000 meteors per hour were visible. I remember being out that evening and being able to still see meteors in the pre-dawn sky during morning twilight. It was amazing. But the typical rate for these particular meteors is very low, only about 15 per hour, which is 5 per hour above the normal standard background rate of 10 per hour. The real issue is, how do you tell them apart from any other regular sporadic meteor? You'd have to trace the trail of the meteor back along its path as you see it streak across the sky, hoping to identify an origination point somewhere near the constellation Leo the Lion. Hence the name Leonid meteors, or Leonid meteors, because it seems to emanate from the constellation Leo.
Now, how does that rate compare with, say, the Geminid or Perseid meteor shower?
Well, the Leonid meteor shower actually is very, very low on the totem pole, generally speaking. It's one of the weakest showers of the sky. There are weaker showers, yes, down to about 5 per hour even, but still recognized as being, you know, integrated meteor showers. Yet for something like the Perseid shower of August, in which we can see anywhere from maybe 70 to 100 per hour, and the Geminid meteor shower of December, which is well up above 100 per hour, we can see that the Leonid shower really doesn't hold much of a candle to the other main ones of the year, of which there are actually only two.
Well, let's move on to some planets then visible tonight.
Venus, the brightest one of the planets that we can see in the evening sky at any time, is low in the southwestern sky and easily visible after sunset. Mars, which is over to the left of Venus, is still hanging well in the southern sky and looks really great. Anytime you look at the planet Mars, you can readily think that there are at least three active rovers on the surface going about learning new information about the planet every day. One of those rovers is actually stuck in a location and, up until recently was acting as a stationary weather station. The other two rovers are still going about their daily tasks of scratching the surface to help us better understand what went on in the early history of Mars.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight.
You find Earth boring, just the same old, same thing. Come on, time.
That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.
You find Earth boring, just the same old, same thing. Come on, sign up without a space, Waze Incorporated.